This episode is brought to you by Yolele, the revolutionary African foods company. Learn more at yolele.com.
This episode is brought to you by Just Egg. You can't have plant-based breakfast without a plant-based egg. You can get started with a free sample. Just head to ju.st/hrn.
This week on Meatin' 3, we celebrate Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month with an episode about memory.
I've always read and sort of approached cookbooks for more than the recipes. To me, they are full of narrative content and narrative value.
So Malama Aina basically means to take care of the land. For us as Hawaiians, it's taking care of our older sibling.
But I do remember like definitely feeling like self-conscious about it, like being the only one who kind of wasn't eating a sandwich and like didn't have a bag of goldfish or Lunchables.
Listen to Meatin' 3 wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, everyone. Bienvenidos to another episode of Cooking in Mexico from A to Z on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Aaron Sanchez, alongside my beautiful mother,
Sarita Martinez.
And we are very excited because we invited an old friend, someone that we absolutely adore. Knowledge is it's in every pore of this man. Of course, we're talking about Coleman Andrews, an internationally known food writer and editor. Is a senior editor specializing in food and lifestyle stories for 247wallstreet.com. He's also the vice president. He was the vice president and editorial director of the dailymeal.com and co-founder and editor-in-chief of Sever Magazine. So he's won multiple James Beard Awards for his outstanding cookbook of the year, also the MFK Fisher Distinguishing Writing Award. You can just go down the list. And he has authored 9 books. So you can just tell that he's going to bring the heat today. And our subject is one that's very dear to my mom and I. We're going to be talking about the Valle de Guadalupe and the food and wine scene there. So welcome, Coleman. We're excited to have you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
It's wonderful for me because I don't know a lot about that subject. For some reason, I haven't gotten to travel so much to Baja California in the food scene, so mm-hmm. I'm here as an avid listener as well. I'm dying to learn.
Okay.
And Coleman, what was your first interactions and encounters in the Valle de Guadalupe in Baja California? When did you start going there, and when did you fall in love?
Well, it actually started before I ever went to the wine region. When I'm from Los Angeles, lived there many years, about until I was about 50, which was about 100 years ago. Back in those days when it was easy to get across the border in both directions, I could wake up on a Sunday morning and around 9 a.m. I in Los Angeles, and I'd call my friends and I'd say, hey, you want to go to Ensenada or Tijuana for lunch? I'd say, sure. And we get in the car and about 2.5 hours, 3 hours down there, we'd have a nice meal, and we'd drive back in the afternoon with some tequila in the back, and we'd be great. Of course, that became less and less possible as the border crossing coming back became more and more difficult. But so that was my first experience of the region. And the first winery I ever went to in the region was not in the Valle at all, but was Santo Tomas. They had a facility in Ensenada itself, and or in Tijuana, rather, itself. And, that was the first winery in Baja. Dates from 1880 something.
Wow.
And long before there was wine inland, they were making wine there. And, if people don't realize when you talk about Mexican wine, they think, well, they just drink beer and tequila, But the first winery in Mexico, I believe, I'm almost positive it was the first winery in the Americas ever. And
wow.
It was not in that region. It was in Guajira, about 15 something, and the winery still exists. I'm sure it's been closed and opened again. 1597 in Coahuila, and in the interior. But The idea that the wine culture, obviously, as you know, it hasn't traditionally been a part of Mexican culture. It was the Franciscans who needed to have wine for mass, and so they planted vineyards, and you know, there's always been a little bit of interest in wine, but not very much until probably, well, the first vineyards, as far as I know, in the Valle de Guadalupe were in the 1930s.
Wow.
And there were farmers from Europe that came there, and that's one of the things they planted. And obviously the climate is very well suited. It's a Mediterranean climate. And you get from, even though you're inland about 30 miles or so from the coast, there's kind of an open leeway to the coast. So you get the coastal breezes. So in the southern part of the valley, especially, so you're not, it's not too hot. It can get pretty hot.
Well, Thomas Jefferson is incorrect for saying he was the first to plant grapes in the Americas, right? No, thank you.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah. You said something very interesting. And I think for our listeners, you know, the Valle de Guadalupe has these salt quarries around the area. So when you taste the wine, and especially in the front palate, it has a salinity that could be very abrasive for some people.
That's especially, it shows up for some reason in the white wines more than the reds. And maybe it's because the more of the tannin in the reds kind of overcomes that and don't notice it as much.
Yeah.
But that's a real problem. And there's people that I don't mind the character. You have some wines from Italy, from the islands in Italy, for instance, the Tuscan coast, that have some of that character for the same reason.
Yeah. Yeah. And they started planting Italian varietals, right, Coleman, in Mexico?
They have everything. They have, I don't know how many varietals, but they have every Spanish, French, Italian varietal you can imagine.
Yeah.
There was a guy, unfortunately now deceased, Antonio or Antoine Badin, whose family was Swiss, and he found an old vineyard of Chasselas, which is the main white wine grape of part of Switzerland, and he made wine from that. That's now the Badin, Mogar Badin. It's now called Mogar, I think, at this Mogar winery.
You know, there was a wine that I used to love from the Valle de Guadalupe. It was a Blanc de Blanc that I think was sold to Conundrum. Do you know anything about that? It was a wonderful white wine.
I wonder if it could have been from one of the bigger, older wineries like Montichanique or something.
No, it wasn't.
Yeah, or L.A. Cheto.
No, but it wasn't that. It was a small winery.
Okay.
And it was sold to the people who make Conundrum.
Yeah. I didn't know that. Well, but to answer your first question, when I first went to the Valle was probably 2003 or 2004.
Okay.
And at that point, you know, now I remember I met on that first visit, I met Hugo da Costa, who is the most prominent winemaker and kind of inspirer of winemakers in the valley. They call him the Mexican Mondavi.
Uh-huh. Oh, cool.
And he told me at the time, he said, there's like 14 wineries in the valley.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, that's great. And then when I was there in 2017, which is the second to the last time I was there. I was also there in 2019, but 2017, I counted signs driving around for 58 wineries, and some people said, "No, there's 100."
Wow!
And you know, which is great, except that there's no water, so it's kind of a difficulty. But when I first went there, say about 14, 15 wineries, and the food scene didn't exist. There was one sort of quote unquote serious restaurant or Baja Mediterranean restaurant, which is what they call the cuisine now.
Manzanilla.
Yeah.
We're Manzanilla. Laja, that's right. Yeah.
Laja, which is Jair Teles, who I think he still owns it, but he's in Mexico City now. He has a place called Mero Toro.
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was part of Contramar.
Yeah.
Well, he's friends with her. Yeah.
With Gabriela.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then so for everyone that's listening, you know, so you basically cross the border through Tijuana, you go above, you know, you go about 45 minutes, and the first real town you'll find is Rosarito, right? Mm-hmm. And then that's kind of, when you go to Rosarito, it's a cool little kind of beachy kind of vibe. There's a good friend of mine named Antonio de Livier, who just opened up a wonderful open air restaurant that you have to visit. I was just there 2 months ago.
Yeah,
And then you start going down the coast, and then I guess, you know, you have little towns interdispersed, and then you find yourself in Ensenada, right? Which is kind of the big town, right? And then let's talk a little bit about what they're famous for culinary-wise, right? They make the best fish tacos anywhere in Mexico. I think that's what we can't debate that. And then you start seeing these really serious chefs. Our good friend Benito Molina and his lovely wife Solange, who have Manzanilla, which has been there for 20 years. Then you have chefs like Javier Plasencia, who is a wonderful chef who has multiple restaurants in Tijuana as well. And and then you have chefs like Diego Hernandez, who is another fantastic chef who does really serious food. So really great caliber chefs down there. Yeah. What are some of the food things that that really spoke to you on your visits?
Well, you know, one of the things I had two kind of epiphanies about the food there. One was when I first went to Laja and I had a very good meal. But I said, it doesn't seem very Mexican to me. It seems, you know, he made homemade pancetta and, you know, and sauces rather than salsas and, you know, and home baked bread instead of homemade tortillas. And I remember my first thought was, well, you know, why isn't he doing more quote unquote Mexican food? And then I started thinking, as I said, I'm from California, and the big thing in California is a Mediterranean cuisine. And then I thought, well, it's the same climate here, and who has more of a right to Mediterranean cuisine than Mexico, more than Alta California, as they used to call it, does.
Yep.
You know, and but then the other real epiphany I had was on a much later trip after Javier Plasencia opened his place, Finca Altozano, which is a wonderful big property, which has a coffee bar and a snack bar and all these different things in this serious restaurant. And I was sitting having lunch with him one day, and I looked at the table and I said, okay, so there's wine made from Tempranillo, from a great Spanish grape that was made a few miles from here. There's olive oil from a few miles that direction. There's oysters, these wonderful oysters that come from the coast of Ensenada, a few miles away. There's really good crusty Italian or French style bread, but there's also tortillas. There's also salsa. There's also birria. You know, this combination, and they're all in the same table, and they all go very well together.
Isn't that crazy?
This is paradise. You know, maybe my two favorite kinds of food would be like Italian and Mexican, and you know, you have them together, and it's legitimate. It's not like somebody's trying to make phony fusion food. It's historically and climatologically absolutely authentic and real, and it should be that way. And that's one of the rare things.
Well, I really resisted that because when I spent a lot of time in Tijuana. My grandmother had a house there. Uh-huh. When I was a teenager, you used to go have carnitas on the way out to Ensenada. There was this great stand there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we used to go to Rosarito to have lobster with beans, you know, with refried beans.
Oh, yeah.
And it was very different. So when I started going more recently and went to Javier's place, I said, this is not Mexican, you know, and I was into the food of Oaxaca and the food of Yucatan. And, and it didn't, it just seemed to me like it was blasphemy, you know, and I didn't understand the situation until I read your piece the other day. Okay. I mean, I'm that much of a novice in this area.
But you know, Zarella, you and I were talking the other day about Lebanese influences and Arab influences around Mexico, and not just tacos Arab, but you mentioned some things that I hadn't heard of from other parts of Mexico that are clearly influenced from that part of the Mediterranean. And then you have things like, you know, the food using olives in cooking, like they do in Veracruz. Is Spanish. It's from Spain. It's not something that you would automatically associate with Mexico. There's always been all of these influences, and it's not to in any way denigrate the indigenous ingredients and foods. But, you know, I think it was Benito said something very interesting to me about he said, you know, we have to go back to our roots in thinking about the food we make. And he said, what single food is more Mediterranean than tomatoes? And they came from here.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, and you're absolutely right, Coleman. And you think about some other iconic dishes from down there. You know, you mentioned the oysters.
Yeah.
They're also really well known for their tostadas, their seafood tostadas, and their cocteles, and their cocteles de mariscos, or like seafood cocktails.
Yeah, along and all these.
And the smoked tuna, you know, the smoked tuna was just like fantastic. I don't know why we don't have it here in New York.
They have these beautiful, you know, they have these pens. You've seen them off the coast of Ensenada, these where they raise the bluefin tuna, and they're raised, they're in effect swimming around wild, but they're enclosed in these in these enclosures, and they harvest them there. The lobster, the Pacific lobster, the lagosta,
and the abalone,
and the abalone,
and then they also have one of my favorites, the chocolate clams.
Oh, those
the clam, the chocolate, almejas de chocolate, which are amazing.
And how do they do them there? How do they make them?
They're raw usually
usually them raw. Although I think I think Benito makes a sauce for them, and you know, and but then these beautiful little spot prawns that I had another good chef down there, Drew Deckman, who's an American from Los Angeles, and he has Deckman's restaurant, and he served me these raw sliced spot prawns with a little lime juice and some chilies and things. And now, man, it's one of the best things I'd ever tasted, you know?
Yeah.
And who else is that? Who is that? Our lovely friend, Carolina, no? Who
Karen.
Writes a Karen Yan, who writes a lot about Baja as well. So she's a great resource as well.
Yeah. And she's the one, actually, she did a lot of research. You talked about fish tacos. And, you know, if you think about it, it's kind of unusual that you would have fried fish on a taco. You have grilled fish or, you know, roasted or something like that. And she did this research and she found out it's because there were, in the 30s and 40s, there were a lot of Japanese fishermen in Ensenada.
Wow.
And this, and especially there's some that came from California when they started in the 40s, when they started locking up the Japanese population in these camps. Some people went across the border to stay away from that. And they started farms and they started they set up fishing operations.
Wow.
And she found, she talked to people that said, basically, you fry the fish for Baja fish tacos because of tempura.
Yeah.
Because that was that inspiration. So that's another example of these influences coming in from elsewhere.
You know, when Aaron was out in Outward Bound for Kids at Risk, I took Rodrigo and this young man that I was dating at the time with his biologist friends of mine for a tour of the Sea of Cortez. And we camped at uninhabited islands every day, and we caught fish and cooked it. You know, I even took some couscous. But anyway, we stopped at a place where there was a big, I forget what it's called, like a slice of earth going all the way down. We were with this biologist friends of ours, Food Riccardi. And you could see all the seafood that had become extinct.
Because
the people would sit at the corner at the bank and eat, you know, the seafood. It was an amazing experience.
Wow,
that's fascinating. And and as we said, you know, you think about the winery, you think about the serious chefs that have set up shop there. And it's a very interesting place that people should definitely visit. It's
right.
You get a little bit of all those elements from Europe that you said, Coleman. Is there any other, where do you think the food scene is going to continue to go and the wine scene is going to go in the future?
The interesting thing about the area, even today, and this might change, but you know, there are people that say, well, it's there are real problems because the people, I probably shouldn't mention her name, but there's a woman there who has a hotel, and she's very much an activist because what has happened as this has become an increasingly popular tourist destination from across the border, but also from parts of Mexico, is that besides all of the restaurants, there are new bars, there are discos now in the valley. And they make a lot of noise late at night. And she says, these farmers have to get up at 4 in the morning and start working at 5 in the morning. And they're kept awake. Like, they can hear this sound. So that's going on. On the other hand, it still is remaining very unspoiled in a way. As you know, you've been there. there are basically two paved roads which go the length of the valley. If you want to go crosswise, even to a nice hotel or a nice restaurant, you're on a bumpy, rutted dirt road, which is nice in a way because people can't go racing down in their Land Rover.
Absolutely.
But what's happening is, I mean, there's a winery called what is it called? Decantos.
Oh, the Descantos that has they have natural gravity.
It's all gravity.
Gravity based. Yeah,
I've been there. Up to this place, and it looks like it could be a show place in the Napa Valley. It's a beautiful architectural, but of course you have a dirt road going up there, and like messy sort of yards around it and everything. But then this building is sitting there, beautiful thing, and the wines are really pretty good, and they have a little snack bar, and they have all this stuff. But that kind of thing, you're seeing more and more elaborate hotels and wineries, but it still has a feeling of really being a real place. And you see, when you're driving around, you see people that are living in little tiny houses that are probably farmers. You see sheep and cattle. You see plants that are not vines. It still is trying to remain a real place as opposed to a Disneyland kind of thing. And I hope that it's able to maintain that.
Talking about sheep, isn't there like a very well-known dish there called borrego tatemado?
Yeah, which is, I don't know if other places serve it, but there's this place where everybody goes for breakfast called Doña Estela. I think it's La Cocina de Doña Estela.
Yeah.
And that's the specialty there. And people eat it. I mean, they come in at breakfast and they have these big plates. I send you a photograph.
Yes, of, that was
a half order.
Yeah.
And it's basically like barbacoa, which would be, of those that don't know, it's basically this roasted lamb with a bowl of a very intense broth on the side. And, the lamb would be shredded. It's basically that, except that the lamb is crispy, it's all crisp and charred, all the shreds. Mm. And it's just delicious. And you wrap it up in tortillas and you dip the tortillas in the broth. And you see people, it's a big restaurant, and you see people eating that. And they also eat, they have very good cornmeal pancakes, we found out. When the last time we were there, we ordered everything on the menu, basically. And I was there in 2019, in October. Carolyn Carreño that you mentioned, and Javier and Nancy Silverton, the chef from LA, started this. I think they've had three now of this festival, Valle Wine and Food Festival. And they didn't do it in 2020 for obvious reasons. I'm not sure if they're going to do it this year. I think maybe they'll do it in spring of next year. But
yeah, I was invited to go. I was invited, and I was bummed out because of the pandemic. Yeah. They had to cancel it, but
it's a lot of fun.
You're right. There's a lot of legislation being championed by a lot of the local chefs and winemakers to sort of preserve the ecosystem down there.
Exactly.
And that's a really positive thing. So if you're down there, you want to help out, get involved a little bit and get informed.
The other thing that they're known for there, besides that, are the flour tortillas.
Yes. Really
good. They have a lot of little stores that you go in and get flour tortillas, but they were telling me that they've consolidated everything into a big store right as you enter the Valle de Guadalupe, and they sell that wonderful cheese that they make. Mm-hmm. Did you ever visit that cheese place?
I didn't, but I've had the cheese. Yeah, and there's several people. There's goat cheese, and there's also cow cheese.
Yeah.
But again, that's another example. They have everything you want. I mean, what more do you need to eat besides vegetables, lamb and fish and olive oil, wine and cheese and bread and tortillas?
So how would you describe the cheese? Is it like a ranch cheese?
Yeah, it's like a white, slightly acidic cheese. It's like a little bit like, you can imagine like a cotija that's softer.
Yeah.
That's a great description, yeah.
But there are a lot of issues there. There's no clinic in the, or there's like a one room, one doctor and one clinic. There's no ambulance there. There's no no sewage system, which they're going to need if they keep expanding. The water is an issue, as I mentioned, and you know, there's all this building on the coast, and they're drawing water from the watershed up there to put apartment buildings down by down on the coast. So there's a lot of issues, and it is very important that they maintain this unique ecosystem, I think. Yep. And I'm really glad that there are these activists doing that.
Well, they had the problem with the abalone, that it's like so expensive to find because the Chinese buy it all for those wedding gifts.
Yeah, exactly. And then our dear friend, who I call my chef dad, Jonathan Waxman, said that, like, it back in the day in the 70s and 80s, abalone was considered bait. It wasn't something that was so beloved like it is now.
Every restaurant that you went to in the up until maybe the mid 80s or late 80s in Southern California, you'd get abalone. They were big. They were about, let's say, 6 inches across, and then they'd pound them so they were about 12 or 14 inches across. And they dredge them in cracker crumbs and fry them in butter and put lemon on it. And that's all. And that was, every restaurant had that. And now the problem is that they became an endangered species and they stopped the commercial fishing in the States. I don't know about in Mexico.
Oh.
But you can't fish them commercially. There's people raising them. But to get to that size that they used to be able to pull off the rocks all the time, to get to that size, there's like 20 or 30 years.
Oh. Wow.
So that's why when you see the farmed abalone, it's usually about 3 inches across or something, and that's probably 5 years old. But abalone is great. But the Chinese have bought most of that, and the same with the sea urchin that the Japanese buy.
Yes.
What do they do with it?
The Japanese?
No, the sea urchin. What do you?
Tostadas like it at. You know that famous cart in Ensenada, La Guerra Rense.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, you that's one of the best things there is the sea urchin tostadas.
Yeah, and it's also a great garnish if you have like fresh tuna tostada, and then you can kind of gild the lily, so to speak, with some beautiful erizo. Yeah. Yeah. And they call sea urchin erizo, which is also called goosebumps. You know what I mean? So that's what it has, that cute little kind of nickname. You know. Yeah. The beautiful sea urchin, which I love. I can't get enough of.
It's great. And you make a sauce with it too. You know, like
you can make a compound butter.
Or a compound butter, yeah.
And then fold it into pasta, and there's nothing more divine with a little bit of lemon and breadcrumb. Oh, that's making me hungry, Coleman. I love it. Oh, man.
I think I had like a risotto at that restaurant Mero Toro in Mexico City with sea urchin. Could that be?
Yes, that makes sense. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I love sea urchin.
Yeah, as you know, it's a very strong flavor, and some people don't like it because it has an iodine flavor, but I love it.
I remember, Mom, we went with our good friend Anita Lowe when she had Anissa in New York City, and she made a flan with sea urchin, and the texture was so obscene. You felt naughty having this thing.
Well, you felt naughty because your head was always there.
Exactly. But sea urchin is wonderful. I mean, you got to really, you know, think about when you're planning a trip down there. You get all the elements of Napa with great Mexican food. Exactly. The people are really amable and really sweet. And it still has that little sort of beachy kind of hippie vibe in different parts.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned the open air place that I think you said your friend had in Rosarito.
Yeah,
and there are more and more of those. In fact, as you know, Benito and Solange have one in the Valle called Silvestre, and they call them campestres. And the campestres are they're open air, and at Silvestre, there's no electricity, there's no gas. It's a big wood oven, basically, and wood grill and everything. They bake bread underneath the grill with the radiated heat that comes down. And they do everything. You know, it's really amazing. Of course, you have to have nice weather, but they're only open part of the year. But when you sit out there under these trees, these old oak trees, and you have this wonderful food that comes right off the grill, pork loin, tostadas, birria, just like roast lamb tacos and things like that.
And you just mentioned, so that my dear friend, who is a big personality, his name is Antonio de Livier. And if you haven't gone to his place, it's recently new. It's called La Media Corriente.
Okay.
Amudadora Rosarito. So it's kind of like he has a big sort of pit in the middle of the restaurant's opener. So if you have a chance, I got to plug my good friend, Antonio de Livier.
Sounds wonderful.
But I think that a beautiful hotel just opened there. I forgot what it's called. It starts with a B, like Bruma, maybe? Or something like
that? Yeah, Bruma.
Yeah.
It is Bruma.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was there before the hotel opened because they have a winery and they have a restaurant. But before the hotel or restaurant opened, I was there in 2017 and they had some sort of guest houses and I was able to stay there for a few days. It's a beautiful property. And the hotel is supposed to be magnificent. And the restaurant, our friend Jonathan Waxman said, was really one of the best meals he had down there. It was at the restaurant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everybody's recommending it.
Yeah.
So I don't know who the chef is.
I think there's a restaurant that is called Orígenes or, I'm going to remember the name, but it was a beautiful restaurant. There's a good friend of mine that I met, a gentleman named Victor. I'm going to figure out exactly where his winery is, but he's a young guy. Right. And I was telling my mom about him. He used to do charraria. So he used to like do horse shows as well.
Yeah.
And so maybe what you can do is I'll give you the information. You can go on to my mom's website, sarela.com, and then we'll post it for you guys.
That's great.
At some point.
Yeah. The other place down there that's really good is La Esperanza.
La Esperanza.
That's Miguel. He used to be called Miguel Angel Yajes, and now he's Guerrero, which is part of his name too. But Miguel Angel has a place in Tijuana called La Carencia.
Mm-hmm.
It's very good too, and he does all these a lot of smoked marlin and smoked fish tacos, smoked tostadas and things like that.
When you mentioned Querencia, you know, Lori, our dear friend, has built this amazing home in Colorado. I mean, it's so beautiful. And they called it La Querencia. And I said, what is that? Why are you gringos always appropriating, you know, names like that? Because they're supposed to be like your safe place or, your comfort zone.
Your sanctuary. Absolutely.
This episode is brought to you by Yolele, a revolutionary African foods company based in Brooklyn, New York. Yolele was founded by Senegalese chef, activist, and cookbook author Pierre Thiam. Yolele creates income opportunities for smallholder farming communities, supports their sustainable farming practices, and shares Africa's ingredients and cuisines with the world, starting with Fonio. Fonio is a delicious, nutrient-dense, gluten-free ancient West African grain. Fonio is also drought-resistant, so it's good for the planet. Yolele is creating a market for Fonio and other African crops grown under resilient farming systems to foster a more biodiverse, drought-tolerant landscape across West Africa. Try Yolele's Fonio, quick-cooking Fonio pilafs, and new Fonio chips boldly flavored with the ingredients and flavors of West Africa. Sign up for their newsletter for recipes, notes from the field, and culinary discourse, and get a free bag of Fonio with your next order of $32 or more. Learn more at yolele.com. That's YOLELE.com.
Just Egg is now the fastest growing egg brand in the United States. Bring more plant-based consumers in your doors with easy-to-use Just Egg. You can get started with a free sample. Just head to ju.st/HRN. That's ju.st/HRN. Made from plants, Just Egg is a better egg for you and for the planet. It's healthier, with no cholesterol and less saturated fat, and it's more sustainable. Just Egg uses less water and generates fewer carbon emissions. Most importantly, it's delicious. For our listeners who operate a food service establishment, you can get a sample for free. Head to ju.st/hrn. That's ju.st/hrn. Just Egg makes a delicious plant-based addition to any menu. It's available as a liquid scramble. Great for omelets, frittatas, stir fries, and French toast. There's also a frozen pre-baked folded version that's ideal for filling breakfast sandwiches or topping salads. Chef Jose Andres calls Just Egg mind-blowing, and Bon Appetit says, it's so good, I feel guilty eating it. Put the fastest-growing egg brand on your menu. Get a free sample of Just Egg for your restaurant at ju.st/hrn.
Coleman, one of the things that we love to do here on our podcast, Cooking in Mexican from A to Z, is keep people informed on what your projects are. What do you have working? What's new? This is time, your time to be shamelessly plugging anything that you that you like.
Yeah, well, I wish I had more to plug right now. I'm very busy, but I'm working for this website called 24/7 Wall Street, which has a channel called 24/7 Tempo, which does a lot of food and lifestyle stories. And I'm working as an editor and sometimes writer for them. That's my day job. And then I'm working with a chef in Los Angeles on his book. I'm not supposed to talk about who it is because it's kind of behind the scenes, but a very good, very interesting chef who's very, very committed to the history and culture of the food that he cooks, which is what interests me a lot.
Wow.
So I'm working on that too. And then I'm actually just started trying to write some fiction again, which I haven't done for a long time. So we'll see how that works out. I can't, I'm not sure where that's going. And meanwhile, you know, like everyone, I think during these last year and year plus, because I've been home a lot and I've been, have not been traveling, and I'm been cooking a lot and drinking a lot.
Where is home for you, Coleman? And do you have a website or an email?
I live in Connecticut, Riverside, Connecticut, which is Greenwich, just over the New York state line. And I used to commute. It's commuting distance in New York City, and I used to go into the city every day. But again, I haven't done that for more than a year. And I don't think I will anymore because the company I work for now has decided to go completely remote, even when we're able to travel again.
Wow.
So
And people can send an email to you. Where can they do that, Coleman?
The best address would be Coleman without an E, Coleman Andrews at yahoo.com.
Right.
So we have the private one. So just to sort of sum up, I feel like we haven't covered the food
with
specific dishes, you know, enough. What would you say are some of the most traditional dishes? And are there any people who are writing about it so people could get recipes? Or do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to talk about traditional dishes there because most of the food is new, you know, from the last 15 years or so. Some of the food, actually, I had a dish. I was just thinking about this. I was looking at some notes of mine, and this wasn't in an article I wrote, I don't think. Maybe it was. But at a restaurant, which I'm not even sure he's still involved with, but Javier Pazencia, his family owns a restaurant, one of many restaurants they own in Tijuana called Villa Saberios.
Yeah.
And I had a dish there that I said was like the definition of the, I guess what they now call Baja Med or Baja Mediterranean, which a lot of the chefs don't like that term. And I understand because you don't want to be characterized by some slang like that. But it was a dish of little baby octopus. A few inches long, like in Italy, they call them moscardini. They're literally 2 inches long, maybe. And this cooked in a sauce of red chilies and garlic. And it was on top of a puree of garbanzos. And then there was a parsley pesto. And then there was yogurt around the edges.
Oh, my God.
And then tortillas.
Oh, my God.
Scoop it up. And it was a crazy dish. I mean, if you think about none of that goes together, but it worked so well. And it had all the flavors, again, of the Mediterranean and of Mexico because of the chilies and the tortillas. in the garbanzos.
Well, you know, one of the things that you said that was so insightful was that we were talking about a particular chef here in New York who's an Anglo making Mexican food, really, you know, doing everything, making his own masa and everything. And then you told me that it was funny how Enrique what was the name of that?
Olvera.
Olvera.
Yeah, from Cosme.
Could take anything and make it taste Mexican. And this other chef could have all the Mexican stuff and it still would not taste Mexican.
Exactly. And I told Enrique that. I said, you know, this tastes and smells like I'm in Mexico. And I go to this other guy's place who we won't mention. And you know, it has all the right ingredients, but it's just different. It's not the same thing.
Yep.
And I that's not to say that you can't, that you have to be Mexican to cook Mexican food, or you have to be.
Look at Rick Bayless.
Rick Bayless is a good example. Yeah. And
Kennedy.
Diana Kennedy, right. But as you know, those are two people that have devoted their lives basically to studying Mexican food in a way that people who eat Mexican food every day don't need to do. They don't, you know, they don't need to study. They know what they like. They know what they eat in their region. They don't care what somebody eats in another part of Mexico, probably. You know, they eat, they know what they do. But these people that come, and I always thought that's my own books when I've written about Spain or Italy or something, I've said, you know, that's an advantage I have in a way. I didn't grow up with this food, so I see it from the outside, but then I can look much more broadly maybe than people that have had that food all their lives that see no reason to go beyond what they know because they know it very well and it satisfies them completely.
Yeah. And that's precisely why my mom had chefs and cooks from Bangladesh and then had Dominicans working during the day because she was worried that if she had too many Mexicans in the kitchen, they would change her food. Right, Mom?
And they did. Yeah. Do you know Jeffrey Pilcher, the man who wrote Planet Taco and Que Viva Los Tamales?
No, I don't.
He's an amazing historian of Mexican food.
Yeah.
And when I first opened the restaurant, he came in with this paper he had done comparing the cooking of Susana Palazuelos, Patricia Quintana, my cooking, and Diana's and Rick's. And he said, you know, Americans going to Mexico and want to be so respectful of the traditions and do the food exactly like they do in, you know, in the little towns. And Mexicans, you know, are used to the food and they'll just put something that doesn't really go there with no qualms.
Right.
And I think that's what you're talking about, no?
An interesting point.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it's great when Rick, for instance, if he's making a mole and he takes all the individual ingredients and roasts them separately and blends them in a very precise way. And then I remember Carolina Carreño saying one time, she laughed and she said, you know, I think she has an aunt or a grandmother in Mexico City, said, she opens a jar when she's making mole.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's very good, you know.
Work smarter, not harder. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Totally.
Exactly.
Well, this has been awesome. This is sort of our love letter to Baja California, to the Valle de Guadalupe. For all of you that haven't had a chance to visit that part of Mexico, it is an absolute gem. Yeah. I encourage it. And like you said, you know, you can cross the border. Sadly, the crossing back probably takes about 2 hours, so I don't want to dissuade people. But
if you're smart about it, you know, there's an app that tells you which of the border crossings, how long the wait is. And if you plan, maybe you leave really early in the morning or you leave in the middle of the day. You know, I've done it recently in the last few years in an hour, something like that. And it's worth it, believe me, to be able to go down there and have this experience.
And also visit all their fantastic food trucks in Tijuana that are changing the food, you know, in the United States.
Well, I mentioned to you the Mariscos Rubén, which is just unbelievable. And I mean, it's the food there and they're from Sonora, but again, seafood. But these sort of grilled tacos, and it's really extraordinary food.
Well, thank you so much, Coleman, for taking the time and participating. And we adore you. We think the world of you. You have such a diverse and sort of broad palate that really adds a lot of a lot of texture and flavor to anything that you research and write about. So
thank you.
Yes, we're really delighted. And again, our guest has been Coleman Andrews. You know, please reach out. We'll have some information on how you can engage with him. We've been talking about Valle de Guadalupe and cooking in Mexico from A to Z on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Aaron Sanchez.
And I'm Sarela Martinez.
Muchísimas gracias. Thank you for joining us today.
Cooking in Mexican from A to Z is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without your support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. En mis entrañas.